supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, as the new year approaches, let's look back at 2009 and see the changes it brought. We experienced, in a way, both triumph and despair. When the year began, we saw through race and inaugurated the first African-American president. The economic crisis, on the other hand, has been crushing for so many families. 2009 pushed us to spend our time in new and different ways. Some spent a majority of the year online, ringing the alarm for many of us mental health professionals. Likewise, some used the web to seek online counsel. Did it work? Does it work? And will it work going forward? The research unveiled in 2009 has changed our perspective about mental health going into the new year. It showed that despite an apparently alarming increase in autism, early intervention works. So as we move into the next year, how do we hold on to the gains, overcome the obstacles that we faced in the past year, and deal with so many other issues there are to deal with? In reviewing this past year, my guests are John Grohol and James Cohen. John Grohol is a founder of the website Psych Central. It's the premier blog about issues in psychology and mental health. John, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back, Dan.
I'm also joined by Dr. James Cohen. He's a clinical psychologist here in the Philadelphia area in Bucks County. Jim, welcome back to the show to you, too. It's been a long time.
Great to see you, Dan.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts about the past year in mental health and what the future looks like to you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. For both of you, we've got to start off this discussion by taking a look at the economy first. John, let me turn to you first. It began to unravel in the last calendar year, but its effects are really being felt this year. We know it's having an impact on marriages. It's increased in domestic violence, depression. So what's your comment on the impact of the economy on us as individuals, and what can be done to remediate that?
Indeed, we've seen on our own support groups a significant increase in the number of people who have come onto the site looking for support and help with, you know, finding themselves in a long-term unemployment situation that they hadn't counted on, and that's been real difficult for a lot of people. And we've seen that. I think the answer is that the economy obviously needs to pick back up. But in the meantime, how people can cope with it is really relying on those kinds of social supports that they have relied on in the past, such as friends or family, and not giving up hope.
You know, Jim, when I get the question, I'm sure all of us in the field get, I get it over and over, and that's, what is the best way to cope? And you know, I give answers, but frankly, it all feels like psychobabble. It feels trite. You know, what are your thoughts about?
Well, in major catastrophic things, I think professionals should have some humility about advice, because unless they're in the experience themselves, it can sound condescending and it's like a pat response. I think the financial situation is worse even than we imagined psychologically, because of the last decade, or certainly the so-called 9/11 fear of lack of safety and control. So in a sort of PTSD way, this on top of that makes people feel very fragile and tragically extremely angry. And it's that anger that messes up relationships, attachments, communities, culture, and polarizes people. So even the resilience that we talk about and the attachments that we talk about are not so available.
I want to come back to the economic issues and talk about the kids, John. What's the information you're getting about the impact on kids?
In terms of the economy, the impact on children really seems to be difficult to tell, because we don't cater to children as much on our mm-hmm. website, so we don't have as much information about that impact. And maybe Jim has something to add here.
Jim,
everything I tend to think of comes through the smaller lens of my practice and my own thoughts about my field. I think probably it's the same as it's always been, depending on the family and depending on the sort of training and sense of unity and purpose in those families. It really has to do with how the children do.
I want to talk about services that are available. Jim, I know you've got some thoughts and feelings about this. Will we be able to get to the skills? Are we able to get to the skilled therapists we need to get to? We know, theoretically, our skills are improving, but are they accessible?
No, not for the numbers. I'm hoping that the changes in healthcare, although there'll be very little immediate results, it may even be worse for a while, but the philosophy that that healthcare is like fire and police and is an essential part of one's life will filter down even more to the mental health world. It's always the stepchild of that. What I do see is patients being much more sophisticated in the kind of care they seek, and that's reassuring,
mental
at least in my
patients.
Practice, yes.
How so?
They seem to get what psychotherapy is. They seem to get that it's complicated. They seem to understand that a diagnosis isn't a shame-based thing, but it often can be enlightening and empowering, and that a collaborative way of working is a very valuable part of their lives.
I'd like to hear both of you comment on the parity bill before we get to the new healthcare legislation. John, let me turn to you. You know, there was a long-awaited parity bill passed this year, which forced insurance companies to, if they pay for physical care, they've got to pay for mental health care. They can no longer discriminate. Do you see the impact of that legislation?
Well, the legislation actually doesn't take effect until January 1st. But we can look at other legislation, such as on the state level, that has also implemented parity before the federal law takes effect. And not surprising, there are some loopholes that are likely to occur again with the federal legislation. One of the main loopholes being that the use of the term medical necessity, which is what's going to be the next battlefield, because I think insurance companies will claim that something isn't medically necessary in terms of a treatment that's being asked for.
Yeah, loophole. I'm shocked. Loophole in legislation, really?
Yeah.
Jim, tell me your take on the parity legislation, because you're seeing the impact in your office.
We had it in the state, and it made a difference because psychiatrists were getting paid so much at one time. And this is many years ago, and when psychologists were put on parity, and eventually I think even social workers by license, that at least made a level playing field for choice of therapists. But I don't know that I understand the legislation, but my concern is this, is one is what was just said about this whole idea of what is necessary. I know when I talk to insurance companies, the representatives on the phone, that one of the things they lobby for is that, is, you know, is this thing really necessary, and how much treatment really will it need? So they give you less treatment, and they might say it's necessary. Their standards of treatment are changed. And the other is that it doesn't change the fee structure. It changes the copayment, I think, is my understanding, that the copayment percentage has to be the same for all treatment. But they're still underpaying qualified therapists so much, it doesn't really help the therapist at all.
You're bringing up another question that I want to address, and that's the issue of medication. Before I do, let's give out the numbers. Excuse me. We're talking about the year in review when it comes to the mental health, even the decade in review, which is something Jim touched on, a decade of anxiety and insecurity. Give us a call. Number's 888-477-9499. What's your take on the year in review? What has changed? What hasn't changed? And what needs to change going forward? So let's turn to you, John. Typically, the first line of treatment for depression and most anxiety disorders is medication. That's commonly accepted. That's the first line of treatment. But, you know, there is some evidence. I think you pointed out in your year in review that psychotherapy is just as effective in medication without side effects.
Absolutely. You can't emphasize that point enough in my book, is that psychotherapy is a very effective tool for depression and anxiety. Doesn't come with nearly the amount of negative side effects that many antidepressants do. And, you know, typically it's the research shows that the combination of the two is the recommended, you know, gold standard, that most people probably should not be started off on one or the other. They really should try both.
Mm. Jim?
Well, I totally agree with John. That's been my experience. The medication piece can often be very helpful, particularly to get someone a little jump-started or something, or for people who have chronic difficulties. But there are many paradoxes about medication. There's a price to be paid for medication that has its own set of effects. Does someone lose their passion for their medication? Do they gain weight? In this culture, gaining weight is a trauma. There is a certain sense of loss of individuality about it. So the psychotherapist, even with medication, is a sort of co-pilot for the patient trying to decide how meaningful that help is and what it means to that person in terms of what medications they even use.
Well, you know, I'm here talking to two psychologists who are advocating for the efficacy of psychotherapy in combination with medication. But, and I'll turn to you, John. So all of this is true, what you guys have been saying, but medication is more accessible, it's cheaper, there's less stigma attached. So that's what insurance companies are going to recommend, and that's what people are more likely to do.
Well, the challenge really comes down to the fact that most people seek out a problem with depression and wanting to talk to a professional about it. They turn to their family physician. They turn to their primary care physician, and they don't turn necessarily to a mental health professional to get started. I think that's where the challenge lies, is reaching out more to primary care physicians and helping them understand the importance of recommending a dual course of treatment for depression. It can't just be one or the other. It really should be both, and they really should be prescribing both equally. I mean, the research that came out this year showed that antidepressant use over the past decade is up 75%, and psychotherapy use was down 35%. So, obviously, that message is not getting out there.
Well, and not just recommending psychotherapy, but how to do it. Many primary care physicians are themselves uncomfortable with the concept and are hesitant to recommend it. Jim?
One of my pet peeves, if you want to call it that, is the advertising medication on TV. I mean, psychotherapy doesn't stand a chance based on the implied promises of medication, and that it teaches the patient to prescribe for themselves, getting the doctor to be their employee. Imagine if psychotherapists advertised the way antidepressant manufacturers do. I mean, we would be, you know, out of business. It'd be unethical beyond our wildest dreams. So people are being programmed to take medication, and they put that whole long list of things at the end that could go wrong, and people just glaze over. So all the criticism of psychotherapy pale sometimes that, and then the advertising skews the whole practice.
Mm. We're gonna take a short break, and when we come back, I want to address where the field is going. There's some interesting developments, including this whole field of neurobiology and relational biology. So that's what we're doing today. We're reviewing the year, even the decade, in mental health. Our number is 888-477-9499. I wonder if there's anything that happened to you nationally that affected your mental health, your sense of well-being, maybe the way you're envisioning your future, your children's future. Give us a call. 888-477-9499. My guests are Dr. John Growall, psychologist, founder of the website Psych Central. It's the premier blog about issues in psychology and mental health. I'm also joined by Dr. James Coane. He's a clinical psychologist in private practice here in Bucks County. And I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Salvation Army proudly supports WHYY. Far more than ringing bells, the Salvation Army has provided food, shelter, and a range of services for Philadelphians in need for 130 years, spending 91 cents of every dollar directly on service provision. When hard times hit, the Salvation Army is there to help. This winter, requests for emergency help are up 30%, and the Salvation Army intends to do the most good possible with donations received. SalvationArmyPhiladelphia.org, doing the most good.
It's the rock fans' ultimate geek out party game. What music would you bring with you to the desert island? I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. And this week on Sound Opinions, we let our guests answer that age-old question. Members of Franz Ferdinand, The Hold Steady, The Flaming Lips, and more choose songs they can't live without to add to the desert island jukebox.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the year in review, even the decade in review in the field of mental health. What has changed? What has not changed? What needs to change? And I'd like to hear from you, not just your thoughts about it, but your experience from a mental health perspective. How has your world changed over the past years? What's had the greatest impact on you and your family, your vision about your future, perhaps? Our number is 888-477-9499. My guests are Dr. James Coane. He's a clinical psychologist in private practice here in Bucks County. Dr. John Growall, he's a founder of the website Psych Central. It's one of the best, if not the best, online. But before we get back to our discussion with them, to me, one of the most troubling things I've read came out in recently about the incidence of autism as high as 1 in every 99 births. It was terribly troubling. So joining us by telephone now is Dr. Craig Neuschafer. He's from the School of Public Health at Drexel University. He's an autism researcher who leads one of the 11 NIH Centers for Excellence in Autism Research. Craig, welcome back to the show.
Dan, it's good to be back.
So, do we have any idea why the incidence seems to be increasing so rapidly? I mean, many argue that our diagnostic skills are improving, but these numbers seem way beyond that.
Well, Dan, really, it really is very difficult to prove empirically what proportion of the increase we've been seeing is due to these diagnostic changes, which, as you know, go far beyond formal changes in diagnostic criteria, but really is all about how very much more aware all of society is about the full range of the autism spectrum. So while it seems that some of this must be driven by some risk factor, we really have a hard time proving that. But we're very interested in researching environmental causes in addition to other causes of autism, and hope that we can, you know, get some answers as we move into this next decade.
Is there any promising genetic research out there?
Yeah, this has been a big year, I think, for autism genetics. A couple of years ago, in 2007, a seminal paper was published that showed that a different kind of genetic event was linked to autism, something called copy number variations. This is different than a gene that's passed down from parent to child. This is an actual change in the number of the units of the code, the base pairs in our genome. They're either deleted or duplicated more than they should be. And what's interesting is these can happen, what scientists say, in a de novo fashion. They can occur in the gametes, in the germ cells, the sperm and the egg of the parents, anew, and cause disease in kids. And it looks like these copy number variations account for about 10 to 20% of the cases of autism.
So what's that mean for the future?
Well, I think for the future, there's a lot of focus on looking at whether or not we can use these copy number variations to come up with ways to screen for autism, although it's very, very much premature right now to say that we have a genetic screen for autism. But just knowing that this mechanism is likely to be a big player, I think, is going to help scientists as they move down that road to try to help families learn how to better predict what the future risks of autism may be.
Speaking of prediction here, the cost for family has been estimated, I think these are your numbers, anything between $2 and $3 million per person. So how does that get paid for? And I wonder if there's anything in the new healthcare legislation for autism.
Yeah, well, that's a complicated question. First of all, those are a couple of corrections. Those aren't my numbers. There was some new research this year from Great Britain that estimated, and these are now the lifetime costs. And this includes the direct care costs, but it also includes what we talk about as indirect costs, costs associated with lost earnings, for example, for adults with autism who cannot fully function in the workplace. So that $2 million figure that they estimated for lifetime costs from Great Britain comports pretty well with a figure estimated here in the United States from a couple of years ago. So we feel like this is the cost, and if you think about that, there are about 74 million children in the United States. You multiply 2 million times the 1 in 110 of those 74 million that are affected by autism, and you get a huge number. You know,
so
the number 135 followed by 10 zeros.
So where does the money come from?
Yeah, the money right now comes from a hodgepodge, a patchwork of places: health insurance, the education system, the social service system, and of course families themselves. And I think that we have here in Pennsylvania, as you know, we've had some legislation at the state level mandating health insurance coverage for autism services. That is something that we see proliferating in other states, and there has been talk. President Obama has named autism spectrum disorders as one of the key concerns for the administration, and I think that we're likely to see a movement over the next few years towards health reform around autism services at a national level.
Wonderful. Let's before we go, let's get to some good news. There's been some good news I read about treatment. I just read an article about the efficiency of treatment for toddlers, that it works. What treatment is it, though? The article didn't say which treatment it was.
Yeah, so there is some encouraging news for families. And before I talk a little bit about that very exciting study that came out in pediatrics this year, something that happened earlier in the year at the International Meetings for Autism Research, which I think connects with this very nicely, is that researchers from the University of Connecticut really painstakingly described for the first time a subgroup of kids that they'd been following for years and years, kids who were certain to have the diagnosis of autism prior to age 5, who reached a point where these researchers said they've achieved optimal outcome. So, you know, using the word like cure, recovery, it's a very charged word, and I think, you know, couching it as optimal outcome, I think, is important. But these kids clearly had come very, very far, and in the ways we test for cognitive and social functioning and adaptive functioning, were on par with their typically developing peers. They did, though, they were at higher risk, you'll be interested to know, for other psychopathologies. So the subgroup of kids are not completely out of the woods, but there's hope. And part of what I think increases the chances of hope is early intervention. And the paper you alluded to, Dan, the model that was being tested was something called the Early Start Denver model. And it combined two intervention approaches that have been around for a while, the Denver approach and pivotal response training. And what's interesting about these approaches is they can be done in any setting. They can be done in the school, they can be done at home by parents who receive the proper training. Fairly intensive, but adaptive. You can use them in a variety of settings. And as you said, these interventions are designed to start with young kids, toddlers, kids who are, you know, anywhere as young as 18 months old. And in the study, they followed up a fairly small group, but it was a randomized design. Kids were randomized to this early Denver model and a comparison standard approach. And the kids who were in the early Denver group had markedly improved outcomes in terms of IQ, adaptive functioning, communication. And so it may be that these kinds of intervention given early are the kinds of things that are going to lead to these optimal outcomes in children as they get older.
Hmm. Say one more time what that model is, Craig.
It's called the Early Start Denver model. And Dan, I know you wanted me to repeat that for the benefit of your listeners. And it's important to know that while we highlight the effectiveness of these models and these kinds of small studies, and I do want to end on a happy note, it is very much a challenge for us to still find ways to bring these kinds of models to large service delivery systems like the public schools, special education systems, and there are a number of folks who are very interested in translating these kinds of models into packages that can be easily disseminated so we can get these kinds of interventions out to the largest number of kids mm-hmm. possible.
Well, Craig, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's really been informative and helpful.
Great pleasure, and have a safe and happy New Year, Dan.
Thanks, you too.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back talking with John Grohol and Jim Cohen about the changes in mental health over the last decade. I want to expand the conversation a little bit and talk about online psychotherapy. I mean, when we talk about where we've been the last year and the last decade and where we're going, we have to address that. So I know it's a really broad question for you, John, so let me hear you take a crack at it. Where do you see us now, and where do you see us going?
Well, as strange as online therapy sounds to people, it's actually been something that's been going on since 1996, so it's something that we have 13 years worth of experience in. Dozens of research studies now. I attended a conference in Amsterdam a few months ago that actually had 120 presentations from researchers from all over the world about different kinds of online interventions for mental health concerns like depression and anxiety. And the research is clearly there. It demonstrates that these kinds of things can be effective.
Well, we talk about online psychotherapy. That's like saying psychotherapy. I mean, I would imagine online therapy is different in everybody's hands. Everybody's got a different vision of what it is and how it works. And add to that, the technologies are different.
Sure, absolutely. Most people who are doing online psychotherapy today are doing it through something very similar to an email exchange, except it's done in a secure environment. But there's also other kinds of online therapy, including real-time chat, where two people are chatting with one another kind of in a chat room or whatnot. And video conferencing as well is growing.
Hmm. Jim?
Well, and I mean this respectfully, so I hope it doesn't come across the wrong way, but I assume that just like Match.com and other sites where people actually try to find meaningful relationships on the internet, there are times it works very well and there are times it doesn't, and there's a whole set of possibilities that wouldn't be available without the online, and a whole set of complications that would show up. I'm not familiar with it. Well, just like all relationships, online relationships have a different set of qualities. That can be really good because in some ways it allows people to open up and say things and do things they wouldn't normally do in a good sense, a kind of anonymity that way. On the other hand, the nature of emotional attachment and the meaning, the interpretations of the transferential aspects of psychotherapy, what does this person mean to me in my life, they call my therapist, that has a whole new set of complications. So you meet someone online, you meet them in person, things change. So I think it's inevitable in some way, but I think obviously it's a self-selected group right now, people who are willing to do it as opposed to people who might not.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, Jim's points are well taken, and I think one of the key aspects of the online therapy modality is that even in an ideal world where therapy was entirely free to consumers to enjoy as much as they wanted to, there's still going to be a large subsection of the population who won't go out and do it, who won't seek a therapist face-to-face, and you might actually run into problems with not having enough professionals to actually provide the services, as is the case with psychiatrists in rural areas, that there simply aren't enough of them to offer the services in those areas. So I kind of look at online therapy as a really interesting modality that has potential, and also the potential to reach a population of people that might otherwise not seek out individual therapy.
Yes, as I have explored it, I mean, there's many people who use online therapy, just like both of you said, who wouldn't get it any other way, who feel either too isolated in fact or too isolated emotionally. And then I've seen people who use online relationships as a way of avoiding relationships also. So
imagine if you had as many patients as people have friends on Facebook.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's that danger of almost having large numbers, I think.
Although I have to tell you, I am involved, and I think I've mentioned it here before, with the Christopher and Dana Reeve webpage. I blog with them once a week. And I watch the relationships with these people on this blog. I mean, these are people who feel isolated in this world, and they are emotionally and geographically. And I watch these relationships develop, and it's really interesting. They are caring. They're compassionate. In a way, you know, I'm on there every Tuesday at a certain hour. I think it's 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock. I mean, I look forward to running into them and seeing how they are. And there's one in particular that I've developed a relationship with, and we go back and forth, and I'm helping her. Just like you described, John, with email relationships, I'm helping her get out of her mind, you know, and take a look at her life moment by moment, and she's terrified. We're going inch by inch. It's really a fascinating experience for me and for her, except as we get through the early stages, I am really craving to see her. You know, I'm she's in the Midwest. I just envision myself going out there sooner rather than later. Jim?
Yeah, I have one sort of variant on that that's happened in my practice, not because I've wanted it to. It just has an inevitability. It's just patients email me, and I am sort of forced, and it's interesting to see what are my ground rules about this. I mean, people I see on sessions, they send me emails, and we have a whole new set of things about what's okay, what's not okay, how does that work. And for the most part, I think it's been helpful to have this extra way of sending messages and not still demanding unreasonable amounts of time.
Well, we've got to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about what I said earlier, the neurobiology of relationships that we talked about. But also want to hear from Mike and Scott, not only our executive producer, but our behavioral health reporter, who's filed a couple of pieces about evidence-based practices and the impact of war on children, which is also a major issue for this year and this decade. But that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the year in review from a mental health perspective. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. What are the important issues to you that have come up over the past year, over the past decade, and what has affected you personally? What's affected your worldview? Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. My guests are psychologist John Growall, founder of the website Psych Central, and psychologist James Cohen. He's in private practice here in Bucks County. Me, I'm psychologist Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Christiana Care Center for Advanced Joint Replacement supports WHYY and wants to help you live a pain-free, active life. Located in Wilmington, just off I-95, the center offers comprehensive programs for hip and knee replacement. Their surgeons perform all the 1,600 total hip and knee replacements conducted annually. The Center for Advanced Joint Replacement at Christiana Care is dedicated to helping patients get back to living their life fully. More information available online at ChristianaCare.org.
Indian singer-songwriter Kailash Kher was having a perfectly fine time singing pop songs and scoring Bollywood films, but he decided he needed to move in a new direction.
There are so much diversity in lives and so much to learn, and that becomes my inspiration.
The result is Yatra, Nomadic Souls, and we'll hear more next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are doing a year in review from a mental health perspective. I like to report in all candor that I am no less neurotic than I was a year ago, but there's always hope for next year. We've got two experts to talk about the year in review. It's Dr. Jim Cohen, clinical psychologist in Bucks County. John Crowall is founder of the website Psych Central. It's really the premier blog about issues in psychology and mental health. Jim, when we spoke to you earlier, you said one of the things that excited you most was the new direction our field is taking, the field of the neurobiology of relationships. And P.S., this is what our next show is going to be about. But tell us what excites you about this.
Well, for me, it's reassuring. Everything old is new again. I'm a music buff, and I have found that turntables make quite great sound with old records. And it seems that a lot of the research and a lot of how we understand the plasticity of the mind tells us that relationships are still the critical factor in how our brains develop, how our nervous system, and the nature of attachment is primary, not secondary, and that we live in a world of connectedness. And so those connections are a truth that therapy can engage in ways that almost no other thing can, I believe, when it comes to mental health, certainly.
Mm. We're going to hear much more about that next year. John, consistent with that, when I read your year in review, which, by the way, was excellent, you noted that psychodynamic psychotherapy, I don't know how to define it, the more traditional relationship-based therapy, that psychodynamic psychotherapy held its own against cognitive behavioral therapy in the treatment of anxiety disorders.
Absolutely. I think it's surprising to some people because psychodynamic therapy, the therapy that has its roots all the way back to Sigmund Freud, is really the black sheep of modern psychotherapy. It hasn't had as much research attention as some other types of psychotherapy like cognitive behavioral therapy. And so it was refreshing to see a study published in this year's American Journal of Psychiatry that demonstrated psychodynamic therapy's effectiveness in the treatment of generalized anxiety disorder. It was found to be just as effective as cognitive behavioral therapy.
Well, I got to tell you something, then, just between you and me, John. I know you've got an app on the iPhone. You've got a cognitive behavioral therapy app on,
we do, yes.
On iTunes. And I have to tell you, I bought it for 99 cents, plus tax, I assume. I didn't check uh-huh. that carefully. Okay. And when I first looked at it, I was just too nervous and agitated and couldn't go through it. And I really felt like I needed kind of a human to help me through it.
Uh-huh.
And then I read your year in review, and you're telling me that psychodynamic therapy is just as effective as cognitive therapy. And when I read that, I wanted to talk to you about getting my 99 cents back.
Well, you know, we try and be therapy agnostic. We talk about what works, and I don't subscribe to any particular theory of psychotherapy. I think if you can show me research that demonstrates it works, I think it's something that has potential value for people.
Well, when I read between the lines of what you just said, sounds like I'm not getting my 99 cents.
Yeah, I'll be more than happy to refund your 99 cents.
I'm kidding. No, I think it's really interesting. So, you know, you talked about evidence, and I want us all to listen to something about evidence-based treatment, because that's the push in physical health. It's also the push in mental health. But when it comes to mental health, it's a bit more complicated. I had mentioned earlier that Mike and Scott is not only our executive producer, but she's the behavioral health reporter here at WHYY. So let's listen to a report she recently filed.
The ideal of evidence-based treatments is the same in mental health as it is in physical health, says psychiatrist Bernard Ahrens. He's director of medical affairs at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C.
Proven, documented, scientifically evaluated practices, interventions, medications that work for different conditions.
Such well-researched, efficient treatments for mental illness exist, but the good news ends here.
Even though there's evidence a wide variety of treatments might be helpful, patient access to many of these mental health treatments is not very good, particularly in certain areas of the country.
That's Anthony Lehman, a psychiatrist with the University of Maryland. He says multiple barriers stand between behavioral health patients and the most effective treatments. Lack of insurance coverage, too few dollars for research, stigma, and a big gap between research and practice.
So a lot of practitioners in the community have learned older kinds of treatment and have not kept pace with the newer kinds of treatments.
Doctors' orders can vary a lot, depending on where a person goes for treatment. Bernard Ahrens.
The same individual, same depression, same history might go to one person and have recommended interpersonal dynamic therapy. Another might suggest couples therapy. Someone else might start with medication, some combined.
The federal government wants to help bridge the gap between research and practice. Drexel University psychologist Michael Lowe received a grant from the National Institute of Mental Health to take one successful intervention from the lab to the real world. This was a treatment for eating disorders based on cognitive behavioral therapy, which changes behavior by pinpointing the thoughts that trigger the behavior. Lowe took this approach to the Renfrew Center, a well-known clinic for eating disorders in Northwest Philadelphia. But creating a link between the lab and practice proved tricky.
We had very different worldviews, and therefore it was extremely challenging to do that.
Lowe's approach focuses on changing specific eating behaviors, dieting, purging, binging. He says the therapists at Renfrew focus on their patients' overall well-being, trying to get to the root causes. Other factors complicated the collaboration. Research settings are more controlled and stable than what therapists encounter in the real world, and researchers lack the kind of interpersonal experience therapists gain in working with patients.
We turn to scales and measures and numbers and statistics, whereas in the clinical setting, what treatment to use and how well it's working is more subjective.
The Renfrew team says the scientists didn't consider lack of patient motivation either. Still, they've incorporated some of Lowe's work into their practice and say the experiment was valuable. Michael Lowe agrees.
It was a very important first step for all of us to appreciate the difficulty. It's one thing to say we have to take these research studies that have been done in this setting and export them to this setting, but that itself is a science.
So, in the meantime, what's a consumer to do? Take charge, says Edie Mannion of the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania.
Try to really think about what it is that you think you have and research it. Don't just go through lists that your insurance company sends you. Ask around, have you ever seen a good therapist for depression or for bipolar disorder? Self-help groups can be a great source of information.
Mental health experts agree on one thing. In this tough economy, they have to get better at bringing best practices to consumers or face cuts in services. From the Behavioral Health Desk, I'm Mike and Scott, WHYY News.
So that was some background information on what evidence-based treatment means, and that's pretty complicated in the field of mental health. I want to turn to you, John. You know, many years ago, I was running a drug treatment clinic, in the 70s, and we did a controlled study about which was more effective in treating substance abusers. Was it marital therapy, couples therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, or medication? And we did an exhaustive study. It lasted over 7 years, and what we found out was the more therapy, the better. It's when you did everything, the outcome was better. So how do you parse out and find out what really works when it comes to mental health care?
Well, that's certainly one of the big challenges that faces researchers in the field, and there are no easy answers to it. They design studies to try and take a lot of that into account and to try and find out the best treatment for a given disorder. But as you saw in your own experiences, that sometimes any treatment or all the treatment together seems to be the most effective. And certainly there's been a lot of research over the years that has shown that a lot of times maybe the specific type of psychotherapy you receive is not as important as the fact that you're simply seeking out treatment and getting psychotherapy help.
Yeah, my experience when I worked with substance abusers and today, that affected outcome more than anything else was, the word comes to mind is devotion, kind of a dedication to the process, to getting better, you know, a kind of commitment. And that alone affected prognosis, I think, more than anything else. These things are really tough to get to. In controlled studies. Jim, I want to change the subject and address something you and I spoke to before the show. And I addressed it in the opening. We elected a year ago this year our first African-American president. What are the implications? What does that mean for us in terms of ourselves, our perspective on race?
Well, as I think you alluded to in your introduction, it's the best of times and the worst of times. That the good news is...
I want to copy that line.
Now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 99 cents is yours. that as human beings, we do our most extraordinary things, our most horrific things in crisis, right? Opportunity and potential disaster. So what I think is happening is that... there was this moment of anticipation and transcendence and high-mindedness. And then as practical reality sets in, we get these tribal, primitive, historic responses that are old. And so human beings evolve by this tension between their aspirations and their fears.
What do you mean, for example?
Well, I mean, Obama really did produce an atmosphere that allowed people to project their hopes and dreams to some degree of change and everything. And then in the practical reality, those fantasies don't come true, and then people go back to their traditional positions, which are often based on generational fears. So it stirs racism at the very same time it encourages us that we can transcend it. And I think then it becomes part of the water cooler conversation. So you see it affecting all areas of life. Families yelling at the TV, you know, that kind of thing, conversations and people polarizing. And one thing I give him credit for is more than the racial part, but is the temperament. That's an extraordinary temperament. And that's a mental health icon that I think we've not seen in my lifetime.
John, do you have any thoughts about the impact of having our first African-American president? Do you see it as significant or not?
Absolutely. I think it's been significant, and it's given a whole bunch of people in America new hope and renewed hope for getting things done through government.
Yeah, one of the things that excites me about what's happening in our culture is the acceptance of difference. You know, when I was my daughter cried to me about the election, and I was saying, isn't it wonderful about an African-American president? She's 35 years old. She says, to me, that's no big deal. You know, what I'm excited about is this is the president I wanted, and that the race didn't mean anything to me. So I'm hopeful that future generations, you know, will be more comfortable with differences, and I think I think that's happening one way or the other. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you both so much. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I think a rich one. My guests have been Dr. John Grohol, who's founder of the website Psych Central. It's the premier blog about issues in psychology and mental health. I highly encourage you to take a look at it. I'm also joined here by Dr. James Cohen. He's a clinical psychologist in private practice in Bucks County. Earlier on, we heard from Dr. Craig Neuschafer. He's from the School of Public Health at Drexel University. He's an autism researcher who leads one of 11 NIH Centers for Excellence in Autism Research. Well, as promised earlier, next week we'll be discussing the neurobiology of relationships. One of our guests will be Dr. Dan Siegel, who's really been on the forefront of this work. Well, if you want to reach us, we are at voices@whyy.org. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been James Thomas. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of radio content at WHYY. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week and have a good year, my friends. Bye-bye.